Welcome back as the IFC presents another episode of the Four Archetypes of Destiny. My name is James Malamus. We've got a great episode for you. Today we will dive into the Maiden's Quest, Bluebeard. It's a great discussion. We can't wait for you to hear it. If you enjoy the IFC's The Four Archetypes and want to support, make sure to rate the podcast 5 stars on iTunes and wherever you get your podcasts. So without any further ado, Dr. Al-Samurai, take it away.
Welcome back to another episode of The Four Archetypes. Dr. Eric Tomlinson is here with us. Dr. Lisa Hung is here with us. And
hi.
Our new addition, our fourth archetype, Whitman Davis is with us. Welcome, Whit. As always, we are going to start something new. So we've been doing Jamp and the Resolution of the Glitch. I hope you enjoyed those episodes. I think there's another episode that's going to be published this week. So I think that's part 6. Okay. So if everybody recalls, earlier on, we started with Von Franz and we did 3 books of hers from the collected works. Well, 2 of the collected works. Oops. 2 of the collected works. And now we're doing the third volume. And the third volume is The Maiden's Quest. So in The Maiden's Quest, this is about the archetypes that Jung described in his theory of psyche. So one of those is that he talks about the archetypal configuration of each human being. He says there is a self, which is the central architect of the psyche. Then there are the complexes, the mother complex, the father complex, other complexes, money complex, cultural complexes. That belongs, what he grouped them all together in the collective unconscious. So the archetypes of complexes come from the collective unconscious for Carl Jung. Then there is the personal unconscious. So that is connected. So that's a layer on top of the unconscious. So if we're thinking of them as stacked, the unconscious, there's the personal unconscious, so collective, personal. Then there is the personal conscious. And then there is the personal preconscious. And the preconscious is always connected to the conscious. So some people dissect them, but they're pretty much one. Now, also in consciousness, there is ego and shadow. So those are archetypal configurations. And so what Jung talks about is that there are different archetypal imprints that move us through the world, that complete us, that this is a sophisticated type of process. So ego, shadow, and then the anima and the animus. The anima is what we call the soul of the masculine. The soul of the masculine is feminine. And the soul of the feminine is masculine. He called it the animus. The reason he did this came directly from his connection to when he went through China and started to learn about Chinese philosophy. This is the yin and yang for Jung. One cannot exist without the other. One finishes the other. One complements the other. And when he talks about the anima and the animus, when he talks about a feminine soul and a masculine soul, he does not mean feminine and masculine as we understand feminine and masculine, like man and woman or woman and man. That's not how he conceptualized it. What he conceptualized was that there is an overall blueprint that has an archetypal pattern that carries these traits. And so it configures that way. But because we are an organism and because we have feminine, masculine in our ideas as an organism. Thus, we're connected to these archetypal imprints. So, shadow, ego, anima, animus. So we're gonna talk about all these because this is where Von Franz comes in. And this work, she is gonna concentrate more and talk about the animus, the soul of the feminine. So we did the book before, which was the heroine's journey. We did the hero's journey. We did the heroine's journey. And this is the maiden's journey, right? The more mature aspect of the feminine for Von Franz. Yes, Whit.
Like to read something.
Sure.
And it's in the...
Go for it.
It's in the very beginning of this this text we have. So it is a quote by Goethe, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, and from Maxims and Reflections, and it reads, "Everything is simpler than you think, and at the same time, more complex than you imagine."
Well, that's beautiful, right? That's exactly what we were talking about. So Jung starts out by making everything very complex. But then as we get into it, it becomes a lot more simpler to understand. But first you have to get through the complexity of it. So this is a great beginning quote. I think we can move into talking about what this book is about. So without further ado, Dr. Lisa, you want to take us away?
Sure. As an intro to this book, I'm going to read from Von Franz's introduction, the first couple of part of the first paragraph, very long one. Here we go. In the fairy tales we considered in the prior volume, the main character, the character of the action, was a male figure, an image of the hero archetype. Since the hero represents the individuation of the man, the tales were interpreted from the point of view of the masculine psychological structure. In many fairy tales, however, a female figure stands in the center of the plot. This is because, as stated at the end of the previous sections, the self manifests in both male and female aspects. Some well-known examples are Cinderella, Little Snow White, and Sleeping Beauty. From the point of view that we have taken until now, this female figure has been considered to be an image of the man's anima, assuming his conscious reality is completely, or to a large extent, ignored, that the plot is driven mainly by the action of figures from the unconscious, and that only at the end do we turn to subjective conscious experience. The more obvious approach would be to take the opposite assumption, that is, the fairy tale is mainly concerned with the symbolized expression of problems of the female psyche. We cannot decide unambiguously if it is more applicable to interpret a certain fairy tale as an expression of the male or the female psychic structures, since ultimately the essential archetypal images stem from the psyches of both sexes. These images reflect psychic components or structures common to all human beings. Nonetheless, the meanings of some of these images is different, depending on whether they have been shaped from the masculine or feminine psyche. So in the last series with the Von Franz, we worked a lot with the view of the masculine psychological structure. And then the series that we're going to be embarking on will go more into the animus, the soul of the female psychological structure.
So we're going to start with the idea of what Von Franz is really talking about. So we're going to start to go through a story. So this is how it works, right? For those who are new to this, we usually start by reading the story and then we discuss the story and do an interpretation of the story. So, Dr. Eric, would you like to read the first two pages of our story?
Certainly. Where would you like for me to stop?
At paragraph 225. Dr. Lisa will take over.
Okay, 225, stop. Okay.
There was once a man.
Gotcha. Famous French tale. There once was a man who had fine houses, both in town and country, a deal of silver and gold plate, embroidered furniture, and coaches gilded all over with gold. But this man was so unlucky as to have a blue beard, which made him so frightfully ugly that all the women and girls ran away from him. One of his neighbors, a lady of quality, had two daughters who were perfect beauties. He desired one of them in marriage, leaving the neighbor lady to choose which of her two daughters she would bestow on him. But neither of the girls would have him and sent him backward and forward from one another, not being able to bear the thought of marrying a man who had a blue beard. Besides, what gave them more disgust and aversion was his having already been married to several wives, and nobody ever knew what became of them. Bluebeard, to engage their affection, took them with their mother and three or four ladies of their acquaintance and other young people of the neighborhood to one of his country seats, where they stayed an entire week. There was nothing then to be seen but parties of pleasure, hunting, fishing, dancing, mirth, and feasting. Nobody went to bed, but all passed the night in rallying and joking with each other. In short, everything succeeded so well that the youngest daughter began to think the master of the house not to have a beard so very blue, and that he was a mighty civil gentleman. As soon as they returned home, the marriage was concluded. About a month afterward, Bluebeard told his wife that he was obliged to take a country journey for 6 weeks at least about affairs of very great consequence, desiring her to divert herself in his absence, to send for her friends and acquaintances, to carry them into the country if she so pleased, and to make good cheer wherever she was. Here, he said, are the keys of the two great wardrobes, wherein I have my best furniture. These are of my silver and gold plate, which is not every day in use. These open my strong boxes, which hold my money, both gold and silver. These my casket of jewels. And this is the master key to all my apartments. But for this little one here, it is the key of the closet at the end of the great gallery on the ground floor. Open them all. Go into all and every one of them, except that little closet, which I forbid you, and forbid it in such a manner that if you happen to open it, there's nothing but what you may expect from my just anger and resentment. She promised to observe very exactly what he had, whereupon, after having embraced her, he stepped into his coach and proceeded on his journey. Her neighbors and good friends could not wait to be invited, so great was their impatience to see all the rich furniture of her house. Until then, they had not dared to come while her husband was there because of his blue beard, which frightened them. They ran through all the rooms, closet, and wardrobes, which were all so fine and rich that they seemed to surpass one another. And after that, they went up into two great rooms, where was the best and richest furniture. They could not sufficiently admire the number and beauty of the tapestries, beds, couches, cabinets, stands, tables, and looking glasses, in which you might see yourself from head to foot. Some of them were framed with glass, other with silver, plain and gilded, the finest and most magnificent were ever seen. They ceased not to extol and envy the happiness of their friend, who in the meantime in no way diverted herself in looking upon all these rich things because of the impatience she had to go and open the closet on the ground floor. She was so much pressed by her curiosity that without considering that it was very uncivil to leave her company, she went down a little back staircase, and with such excessive haste that she had twice or thrice like to have broken her neck. Coming to the closet door, she made a stop for some time, thinking upon her husband's orders and considering what unhappiness might attend her if she were disobedient. But the temptation was so strong she could not overcome it. She then took the little key and opened it, trembling, but could not at first see anything plainly because the windows were shut. After some moments, she began to perceive that the floor was all covered over with clotted blood, on which lay the bodies of several dead women ranged against the walls. These were all the wives whom Bluebeard had married and murdered one after another. She thought she should have died for fear, and the key, which she pulled out of the lock, fell out of her hand.
After having somewhat recovered her surprise, she took up the key, locked the door, and went upstairs into her chamber to recover herself. But she could not. She was so much frightened. Having observed that the key of the closet was stained with blood, she tried two or three times to wipe it off, but the blood would not come out. In vain did she wash, even rub it with soap and sand. The blood still remained, for the key was magical, and she could never make it quite clean. When the blood was gone from one side, it came again on the other. Bluebeard returned from his journey the same evening and said he had received letters upon the road informing him that the affair he went about was ended to his advantage. His wife did all she could to convince him she was extremely glad of his speedy return. Next morning, he asked her for the keys, which she gave him, but with such a trembling hand that he easily guessed what had happened. "What?" said he. "Is not the key of my closet among the rest?" "I must certainly have left it upon the table," said she. Fail not to bring it to me presently," said Bluebeard. After several goings back and forth, she was forced to bring him the key. Bluebeard, having very attentively considered it, said to his wife, "How comes this blood upon the key?" "I do not know," cried the poor woman, paler than death. "You do not know," replied Bluebeard. "I very well know. You are resolved to go into the closet, were you not?" "Mighty well, madam. You shall go in and take your place among the ladies you saw there." Upon this, she threw herself at her husband's feet and begged his pardon with all the signs of true repentance, vowing that she'd never be more disobedient. She would have melted a rock, so beautiful and sorrowful was she, but Bluebeard had a heart harder than any rock. "You must die, madam," said he, "and that presently." "Since I must die," answered she, looking upon him with her eyes all bathed in tears, "give me some little time to say my prayers." "I give you," replied Bluebeard, "half a quarter an hour, but not one moment more." As soon as she was alone, she called out to her sister and said to her, "Sister Anne, go up, I beg you, upon the top of the tower, and look if my brothers are not coming. They promised me that they would come today, and if you see them, give them a sign to make haste." Her sister Anne went up upon the top of the tower, and the poor afflicted wife cried out from time to time, "Anne, Sister Anne, do you see anyone coming?" And Sister Anne said, "I see nothing but the sun, which makes a dust, and the grass, which looks green." In the meanwhile, Bluebeard, holding a great saber in his hand, cried out as loud as he could bawl to his wife, "Come down instantly, or I shall come to you." "One moment longer, if you please," said his wife. And then she cried out very softly, "Anne, Sister Anne, dost thou see anybody coming?" And Sister Anne answered, "I see nothing but the sun, which makes a dust, and the grass, which is green." "Come down quickly," cried Bluebeard, "or I will come to you." "I am coming," answered his wife. And then she cried, "Anne, Sister Anne, dost thou see anyone coming?" "I see," replied Sister Anne, a great dust which comes on this side here. Are they my brothers? Alas, no, my dear sister, I see a flock of sheep. Will you not come down? Cried Bluebeard. One moment longer, said his wife, and then she cried out, Anne, sister Anne, dost thou see nobody coming? I see, said she, two horsemen, but they are yet a great way off. God be praised, replied the poor wife joyfully. They are my brothers. I will make a sign as well as I can for them to make haste. Then Bluebeard bawled out so loud he made the whole house tremble. The distressed wife came down and threw herself at his feet, all in tears, with her hair about her shoulders. This signifies nothing, said Bluebeard. You must die. Then, taking hold of her hair with one hand and lifting up the sword with the other, he was going to take off her head. The poor lady, turning about him and looking at him with dying eyes, desired him to afford her one little moment to recollect herself. No, no, said he, recommend thyself to God, and was just ready to strike. At this very instant, there was such a loud knocking at the gate that Bluebeard made a sudden stop. The gate was opened, and presently entered two horsemen who, drawing their swords, ran directly to Bluebeard. He knew them to be his wife's brothers, one a dragoon and the other a musketeer, so that they ran away immediately to save himself. But the two brothers pursued so close that they overtook him before he could get to the steps of the porch, when they ran their swords through his body and left him dead. The poor wife was almost as dead as her husband and had not strength enough to rise and welcome her brothers. Bluebeard had no heirs, and so his wife became mistress of all his estate. She had made use of one part of it to marry her sister Anne to a young gentleman who had loved her a long while, another part to buy captain's commissions for her brothers, and the rest to marry herself to a very worthy gentleman who made her forget the ill time she had passed with Bluebeard. The end.
Thank you, Lisa. So let's start with the story. The story is a little complicated, a little murderous. So we have what von Franz calls a demon wizard with a blue beard. And the way he thrives is that he slaughters his wives. And that's how he thrives. He feeds off their fear and their greed and their envy, but also he feeds off their energy, their youth. So von Franz talks about how the father of the bride in Bluebeard doesn't exist. It seems like he is not there. And how the animus is split off. The more the animus is split off, the more likely you fall into these relationships. Because when the animus is split off, that means it's projected onto someone else. Someone else carries your animus. Somebody else carries your soul. So the girl is also not in her body. She is projecting her fear, her rage, her entirety onto Bluebeard. So in the story, Bluebeard, archetypal magician, demon, which means that an evil magician has been taken over and is terrorizing these people. And he's terrorizing the women of the town. So actually, this is one of the earliest stories of a serial killer in fairy tales. So we always like to talk about how it relates to our life today and how these things relate. How do we fall into relationships that become very toxic, very damaging, very controlling, right? Where does she really go? So if we think of the fairy tale in archetypal terms, where does she go? She goes deep within the castle. If the castle is a structure of the psyche, she sees the splendor of the psyche. She sees the splendor of the self. She sees the beautiful furniture. She sees the beautiful surroundings. As she goes deeper into the unconscious and she opens the door, what is the key?
It's a magical key.
Perfect. So it's a connection to the inner world, right? We talked a lot about this in previous episodes about the upper world and the underworld. In the psyche, there are deeper layers of this world. And you go deeper and deeper into your psyche and you find things that you did not suspect were sitting there. What does she find down there? She finds her worst nightmare.
She finds the truth.
First, it's her worst nightmare.
Yeah.
That becomes the truth of her situation. Why is it her worst nightmare? Because she can imagine that she would walk into that situation. Okay? The more disengaged, the more split off you are psychologically, the more you tend to be surprised when you walk into dangerous places. Because you are split off, which means parts of you don't know where you are going. And you don't know those parts of you. So what happens is you face the fear that is split off. Her initial instincts are to stay away from this man. There's a reason all his wives disappear. It's not like she didn't know. Everybody knew his wives disappeared. Nobody knew where they went. But still, she's drawn to him. She thinks
that's not what the story, that's not how the story tells it, though. The story tells it that he has a beard.
Correct.
That is horrible. That is, you know, ugly. So there's something, there's vanity going on, but there's like this clue at the same time that there's this ugliness about him. And then the story reveals that, the women of the past that he's married are not there. I don't know. I find significance in that. That there is that, that aspect of him physically, which maybe is a result of something that is wrong, that manifests itself physically, that is wrong with him. We were talking about the disembodiment.
Correct.
So the beard is a physical manifestation of the disembodiment.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's possible.
Okay.
The women originally when they meet him, he scares them off. The idea is to bring them to him and make him closer to them. So the animus in Jung's idea comes in the dream as any dream comes either as a stalker, comes as a serial killer, comes as a nemesis, comes as somebody who is assaulting you, somebody who's coming after you. And what that shows psychologically is that they're disconnected. That you are disconnected from your psychological self. which is the soul. You're disconnected from that part of you that makes you whole. So if you're masculine, that would be your anima. Then Bluebeard is not a typical human being. He's possessed by a demon. Right? And the demon lusts for blood. The key for Bluebeard is it's a trap. Mm-hmm. The key to her is a gateway. It's an opening to another world. What she discovers deep within herself is that she has been not looking deeply enough into her soul. She hasn't seen Bluebeard. She hasn't seen the ugliness. She was afraid of Bluebeard, and she found him ugly, but she hasn't really met the ugliness. That's what she meets in the story. She meets the ugliness of the reality. She meets that part of herself that she has shunned. Go on, Lisa.
I'd like to bring both of your ideas together because sure. I think you brought up a great, interesting point, Whitman, about the blue beard representing a physical manifestation of the darkness in his soul. And I think in a way, such a arrogant, power hungry, lustful person like Bluebeard, in a way he knows he's profiling his victims, and they've all these women have come there and they've all been lured by charm and wealth. And they've all overcome overlooking his blue beard, which is grotesque in their culture community. And he is preying upon these women who are going to, overlook these obvious garish things, which, you know, which are superficial, a blue beard, but overlook them to justify a more desirous, their own desired goals of wealth, ambition, and so it's an interesting. They're both and Dr. Lahav, you're saying that both of these characters are disembodied, both Bluebeard and the young girl. They're both not really connected with who they are, what they want, and they're not in the healthiest of balances. And so it's interesting connecting that with the Bluebeard and the demonic characters.
So on page 75, Von Franz says, the symphonic xenomorphic shadow of the woman, that is her instinctual driven nature, is connected with the dark demon. Or conversely, she's talking about Bluebeard's wife, that the female aspect of the demonic realm can corrupt the consciousness of the woman. So he corrupted her through greed, through gold, through silver, through... A beautiful touch in this version is that the heroine brings the light of the animus figure. So she brings the light. The animus figure comes from where? They come riding across the hill, right? There's sun behind them, and that sun raises the dust, and then there's green, right. And green is a symbol of life. Greens means that you are going to be saved, right? Mm. So if you see yellow or you see black, that means death is coming or death is here. So yellow usually means disease. So symbolism in colors, archetypal colors. Because when the crops turn yellow, that means the crops are dying.
Okay.
And when the fungus starts to grow on those dead, the fungus is black. So this is how they used to measure things, because they measure it based on, these were agricultural communities, right? This is way pre-industrial. This is way, way back, right? In the fairy tale, they still lived in remote places and big houses for those who had money and lived away from each other. They used horses. They used a means of travel. So when you were wealthy, you were super rich. You were more Bill Gates than anything else. They're talking about Bluebeard. They're talking about somebody with massive amounts of wealth, a multi-billionaire at that time, in our time. So when we're thinking about the demonic part of the soul, we're talking about shadow. So von Franz is talking about shadow. And so when we say disembodied, we also, she's also disembodied. That means she's split off. And she split off from what? Her shadow. She split off from her own evil. She split off. So the more you are split off from your shadow, the more dangerous you are. That means there's something that lurks within you that could take over you, and you would not know because it's disconnected from your conscious self. Shadow needs to be connected. You need to know when you're being evil, when you're being angry, when you're being destructive. You need to be conscious of it. That's the only way you can mitigate it. If you're not conscious of it, then it just takes over and basically forces you to do what you think you shouldn't do, right? Takes over consciousness. That's why we call it a complex, right? So complex and archetypes, archetypes and complexes, same thing. They come from the same energy. Okay, so don't confuse them. There are collective complexes, there are collective archetypes, and then there are personal complexes. Like the personal mother is a personal complex. If you had a mother, if you grew up as an orphan, they would become the archetypal mother and the archetypal father because you never had a personal. So you don't have a mother complex per se. You have an archetypal complex. Your archetypal complex is that the great mother abandoned you. So it's a different form of complex. It takes on a different feature because the mother is absent, or the father is absent, or both are absent. So if there's nobody to fill those roles, it's very difficult to project those things onto people. So not having a father for this woman, she was disconnected, disassociated from the masculine. It was her, her sister, her mother. And then there's these mysterious brothers that appear at the end to save her. Because at the beginning, we didn't hear about the brothers, but they appear at the end. And that's when she starts to find that light within her, that power to fight, that power to reconstruct, to pull together the pieces of ourselves. We walk into dark places because we don't know what's there, because we have been scared of that thing and we have put it away. We have put it under lock and key. We buried it. She basically exhumed the body. She went into that area. She was expecting what? She was expecting more. She was expecting more riches. She was expecting something grand. He was hiding a much bigger treasure. She wasn't suspecting that he was hiding body parts, right? She was not, because she was disassociated, disconnected from that. The more disconnected you are, the more von Franz would talk about, the more demonic it becomes. It carries a, because it's not in consciousness. what's not in consciousness can't reflect on what is in your immediate surroundings. So if you lived in a pristine environment and you lived by completely being taken care of, you wouldn't see somebody who was like that. They would take you by surprise because you've never met them. You don't know who they are. You don't sense the danger. She doesn't sense the danger. At the beginning, as Witt said, they found him grotesque, but they didn't trust their instincts. They went ahead. The reason they didn't trust their instincts is because they were disembodied. Right?
I think it also is, it's sort of a interesting commentary on men.
Sure is.
Because here's this singular provider, powerful, but actually more than that, I guess maybe what am I trying to say? At the time, I guess power would have been kind of inferred by his wealth. But you have to transport ourselves back to that time. But and then, you know, but there's something gruesome about him, and you know, she discovers that, you know, we didn't talk about it, but she seeks truth. She can't hold back. She can't withstand this huge, like, desire to see what is in the locked door. That's like the most compelling thing. I mean, that's such a human thing, you know. Don't look in the one door. Oh,
well, it's a trap, right?
I'm gonna look in the door. Like, and then the key, you know, once she does, there's no turning back. Once she's unlocked it, there's total, she cannot, you know, wash the blood off the key. It's completely, you know, she's done it. She can't hide it. The person cannot, once they've gone there, there's no going back. And then, but anyways, back to the commentary on, you know, men, there are these brothers, you know, like, who come save the day. It's this reliance on, I sense that there's, you know, I mean, I see that there's this reliance on men. So one is the villain. Then there's the, you know, the saviors who are come riding in, you know, with the glory, you know, and slay the villain, you know, I mean, but she's in the middle. She didn't kill Bluebird. Bluebeard. you know, she didn't revolt. She didn't find the sword and, you know, thrust it through him. She relies on her brothers, the mysterious brothers that, like, we don't even know their relationship.
Well, they're symbolic of the feminine, the masculine soul, right? So the feminine soul, which is masculine.
One thing.
They reflect the two sisters, the two brothers in Von Franz reflect the two sisters. They are actually not men. And Bluebeard is not a man. He's a demon. And what they're confronting is the animus. They're confronting their inner masculine. They're confronting their inner masculine. So there is a part of the inner masculine that is helpful, freeing, liberating, protecting. And there is a part that's oppressive, dangerous, killer. So
he's not even supposed to. So the point Okay, so this is way over my head.
No, it's just von Franz talking about from
he's not a
from,
man.
So
he's
if we
not a...
if we took it from Bluebeard, so we could interpret the story from different angles, right? We could we could dissect the story as an overall story. Von Franz is interpreting it from the view of the feminine, from the maiden's view.
Yeah.
She's not interpreting from Bluebeard's view, right? She could interpret it from Bluebeard's view, right? She could talk about the feminine and how the feminine is falling, that his feminine is weak and not conscious. But that's not what she's interpreting from the feminine view. So from her character, from this character, the wife, the sister. So there's two that come across from the sun. They appear from the sun. They're magical characters, right? Because you cannot kill a demon with swords. You would need forces that are like angels. So these two men come in as symbols of the masculine, but they're the internal masculine. It's actually her and her sister.
Hmm.
These are their parts that fight back. But in the story, it's given as the characters, the male.
So you're describing the brothers and the sister, the
sisters.
Two girls, the two sisters, as a collective,
yes,
singular entity.
That makes sense.
And they all represent both have the anima and the animus in this entity, and collectively they slay
yes,
the demons.
Yes. So their animus is what slays the demon, but it's it's her and her sister actually who kill him.
Mm.
So that's the literal. That would be the literal. This is would be the metaphoric. So von Franz is entering the fray from a different perspective. She is taking the perspective of what it is to be feminine, to be a woman, and to have the masculine energy. The masculine energy that is disconnected, dissociated from the feminine, and the masculine energy that is connected, right? She actually, this woman needed to evolve and become more conscious of her own power through her fear and dread to save her life. She had to call upon her inner resources. She had to face the demon within. Okay, who can face the demon within? Well, it has to be the angel within. It has to be the good within that faces that demon. Okay, so she has to battle it out. Right? She calls for her sister's help.
She did. She bought some time.
Correct.
She bought a lot of time, a couple
yes.
of times.
Yes.
And she got her sister help, and
yeah.
she had her sister get her brother's help.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she taught. So the bluff was with Bluebeard is she talked his language. She said, "I just need some time. You know, my faith is sewn up. Yeah. You know, just give me some time." Okay. So she plays for time. You know, when we play for time, what are we doing? We're trying to think of a way to face a situation that came upon us very, very quickly. Something that made us like consciousness comes upon us very quickly. Once we have consciousness of the situation, it changes our perception of the situation, like our early conversation. When we have consciousness of a situation, suddenly the situation changes into something very, very different. That was our entire like pre-broadcast conversation was about what are we conscious of or what are we not conscious of? And how does that affect others around us? Right?
Yeah.
This is the Bluebeard story. It's like the more conscious you are of the danger around you, the more conscious you are of self. Become conscious of self. Reflect on self. Because if you don't, you can be in danger. You could lead yourself into dangerous situations because you are not reflecting on self. You don't know all the pieces. That was Jung's overall idea, is like, know all the pieces that make us up. That way, we can move towards what he called the individuation process, which is the integration of these pieces makes us more conscious, stronger, healthier, more intact, more connected, more part of the collective than to be disconnected and dissociated. And we use dissociated a lot because we talk about trauma a lot on this show. But he would agree, disassociation is a problematic aspect that needs to be resolved. So, but it's also a defense mechanism. So it also a defense mechanism against things that are extreme.
I really enjoy this term interpretation. I think this goes right back to your quote, Whitman. Everything is simpler than you think, and at the same time, more complex than you can imagine.
Yeah.
So that quote by Goethe gives us that Whit read early on, gives us a perspective of how we look at complexity and how we see simplicity. You know, how we tie ourselves in knots and not know how to untie them.
I think
Dr. Eric.
Yeah, I think one of the
You've been quiet, Dr. Eric.
Yeah, well, yeah. Lisa got my first main point.
Oh, okay.
And Whitman kind of got my second one. Okay. But there are, I still have a couple observations in addition. One is that it just never ceases to fail me in that when we want to fight our demons, we need help.
Ooh.
Trying to fight our demons by ourselves is usually a losing battle. Ooh. At best, stalemate. Ooh. And another thing that I thought was very interesting is the age difference. There's apparently, and this has been going on for several thousand years. It's not uncommon for men of his ilk to marry, and then in this case, it was the youngest daughter, to marry women who they're 2 to 3 times older than. She was the youngest daughter. He had already been married several times, killed his wives, very rich, et cetera, et cetera. So I think her demon side, no father, apparently, at least in the story. And she gets enraptured by this guy who at first she was turned away from by his outward appearance. But then after he showed her, you know, a freedom, a sense of fun and riches and et cetera, it said that she started viewing him as a civil gentleman. So as you've already talked about, sociopaths, that's one of their best, the intelligent ones, that's one of their best attributes is, as Lisa said, being charming. So he won her over. I mean, and she's young, immature. She doesn't know. And it just reminds me of how much we see. Now, we saw that for, again, several thousand years. The Middle Ages are just filled with it. And then in the end, she gets saved. She's gone through this experience.
Saves herself.
She's being helped. She was helped to save herself. Yes.
And she saved herself.
Let's go back to that in a minute.
Yeah.
Go back to
that's an important point, by the way, that she saved herself.
Yes.
She wasn't saved externally. She saved herself.
And so it's not the other people helping those other people are representations of other aspects of herself.
Correct.
Yeah.
She saved herself. She knew.
They came from the sun, through the dust cloud, in the green, and they pulled out two swords and slayed him.
Agreed.
Two women.
I agree.
They're two women, right?
And I'm not trying to insinuate that it didn't have to come from her because
No, it's not insinuating. This is an important part of the story overall, von Franz's message, her interpretation of the story.
Now, having fully accepted that, I now want to add to that by saying one of the main ways that that can happen within a person is the means of other triggers that come from other people to bring that out within ourselves.
Okay.
Sometimes that doesn't come out of ourselves unless we're helped by other people.
I would love to expand on that idea, saying the stressful situations when we are under stress, that is our moment when we are more desirous to change. We know something needs to be different because this stress will not stand. It will not stand, man, right? So at that point, we know something needs to be different. That's when we look upon resources and may go externally to ask for advice, support, expansion, portals. But ultimately, individually, you take that step through that door on your own. That is your own choice.
Absolutely.
You save yourself.
Absolutely.
We save ourselves.
Understood.
In the end.
Understood. And we use a variety of means to accomplish that. And one of those means that we use to accomplish that is the help and support of other people.
Dr. Eric, let me illuminate you a little bit.
Is that not true, what I just said?
Yeah, that's true. But let me illuminate you just a tad. Do you know the movie Black Widow?
I do not.
Teresa Russell?
Not seen it.
Teresa Russell, this is like a movie that I think about 20 years ago came out. It's called Black Widow. So basically, she marries these older men, and she poisons them, and she moves from man to man. And the woman who basically, the woman FBI agent who tracks her down, because most people didn't believe that a woman could do this. So, but she believed it was a woman. She believed that she was tracking a serial killer. Okay. So they face off at the end of the movie. I don't want to give it away if people want to see it. It's a really good movie. That, for von Franz, if von Franz was watching that movie, she would say, oh, that's the story of Blackbeard. That's the story of the Fisher's Bird. Because that would actually tell von Franz. Von Franz is picking out stories from 400 or 500 years ago. 1,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago. So today, that would be the modern Blackbeard story. Because her animus, Teresa Russell's character, the Black Widow, is demonic. And it's projected onto these men. So she marries these older men, and the night of consummation of the relationship through the marriage, she poisons them. Usually in the wine. So when we're thinking from von Franz's work of the Maiden's Quest, we're thinking, how does the maiden stay intact? How does the woman stay intact in the story? How does her aspects of her masculine projections are understood? And how they have different faces. So she is not literally interpreting the story. She is figuratively interpreting the archetypal structure of the story through the feminine perspective, through the female perspective. Let's put it that way. So not feminine, because feminine means, we said masculine, feminine means soul. So the female perspective. So that's her in. And when we like move into the next story is called Fitcher's Bird, which is very similar to the story, a little different. You will see how she's moving towards individuation of the maiden. So these are stories about the maiden's individuation, how she becomes whole, how she finds herself, how she recollects her pieces. So with that, we are the four archetypes, and we will be back next week with Von Franz, Archetypal Symbols and Fairy Tales, The Maiden's Quest, and we will pick up on the Fitcher's Bird to expand and elucidate the story a little further so you could see different aspects of what we're talking about. Think about different aspects. Dr. Eric's points will be reflected in next week's story, because next week's story is going to bring a lot of what he's talking about into the picture in a more colorful way, if I may. So we're going to go through these stories and we're going to look at the aspects. Even though this story is called Bluebeard, Von Franz is not sitting there interpreting the perspective of Bluebeard. That's why when you interpret a story, you interpret it from a perspective. And her perspective is from the female character in the story. And that's how she's moving in these stories. And in this story, the female character is a heroine, right? She saves herself by slaying Bluebeard. So, with that, we are the Institute for Conflict, and we are not afraid.
We are not afraid.
We are not afraid.
We are not afraid.
And we will be back next week with another episode of The Four Archetypes. See you next week, everybody.
Thank you for tuning into The Maiden's Quest, Bluebeard. We hope you enjoyed hearing from Dr. Alzheimer, Dr. Eric Tomlinson, and Dr. Lisa Hong, and Whitman Davis. You can also find us on the IFC's YouTube. Make sure to check out the JAM Institute for Trans Magicians Call podcast as well. The IFC is a non-for-profit institution. We do not have any paid advertising for our podcast, but we do accept donations. All donations and contributions are tax-deductible. You can find more info at theinstituteforconflict.com.